There, this is the romance program. I'm volunteer Jeannie Yost for Sun Sounds. I've got one story coming up from True Romance Magazine. It's called Get Rid of His Mistress. Here's the story. Just north of San Francisco is a lovely little seaside town decorated with old Victorian homes. I never thought it possible to fall in love with a place, but the first time I found myself standing in front of one of those stately old buildings, I felt as if I'd come home for the first time. I'm what some people call a military brat. My dad was in the Navy. Later, he became a contractor for a big company that specialized in government contracts. So we moved from Virginia to California. I wasn't happy about the move. From what Daddy said, we'd be living inland. We'll be just a couple of hours away from the mountains and an hour away from the beach, he said. You're going to love it. I didn't love it. I hated the house, the food, the brown foothills, and the smog. Worse, Mom was pregnant again, and the house Daddy bought only had 3 bedrooms, so guess where the baby was going to sleep? She put a crib in my bedroom. I rebelled the only way I knew how. I begged Mom and Dad to send me to live with Grandma. They were vague about it, so I called Grandma myself. She told me that it wouldn't be a good time for me to come and stay with her. Although she reassured me that she loved me dearly, all I heard was the rejection. I decided that my entire family hated me, and I secretly packed my things and prepared to run away. Mom and Dad confronted me before I had a chance to put my plan into action. Mom had discovered my carefully organized backpack when she was cleaning. She and Dad demanded an explanation. I burst into tears and told them how much I hated living in our house. Mom pressed her lips together and didn't say a word. Daddy yelled at me that I was a darn fool for thinking that I had it bad. I cried myself to sleep. A couple of days later, Mom asked me if I'd like to have lunch with her. I eyed her with suspicion. She'd never spoken to me in this adult way before. I mean, it was almost a formal invitation, and I didn't know what to say. I bowed my head and mumbled, "Yeah, I guess so." Mom came to my school wearing a beautiful pale green suit. Even the other girls that I didn't really know, asked if she was a model. She was pregnant, but beautiful. I sailed off to lunch with her, feeling prouder than I'd felt in my life. Over hamburgers and French fries at a nice family-style restaurant, Mom told me that she'd been thinking about my dilemma and she had come up with a solution that she thought I might like. She had heard about a little school that had its own beach, boarding stables for horses, and a really good caring staff. She wondered if I'd like to go there to live. "You mean like a boarding school?" I asked. My heart was beating wildly. Were my parents sending me away forever? "It is a school where you'd live," Mom stated slowly, "but the apartments are just darling, and I'm sure you'd like the other students." I went back to school not knowing what to think. On the one hand, Mom was suggesting that I run away within the confines of leaving to go to boarding school. On the other, I wanted one of my parents to beg me to stay. I wanted to be cherished so much that they'd be willing to give up my 2 brothers and the baby on the way for me. That weekend, Daddy drove us all to the school where we met with Miss Mumgrat, who gave us a tour. Mom hadn't been exaggerating. The school was beautiful, and the little dormitory rooms were made to feel like small studio apartments. I couldn't wait to live there. The best part of the trip was when Daddy drove up the coast to a little town and I saw my first old California-style Victorian house. I nearly cried because it was so lovely. All the way home, I fantasized about what it would be like to live in one of those beautiful homes. Instinctively, I knew that the floors were the shiniest wood available, with oriental carpets and deep, luxurious couches and banquets. I was desperate to collect turn-of-the-century furniture and pottery, because that was the only thing that would fit into my Victorian dream. Someday I'm going to live in one of those little houses, I announced. I'm going to go to school, get a good education, and make enough money to buy one. I'm sure you will, Mother said. She winked at Daddy. I knew that my parents thought I was indulging in a childish dream, but I'd show them. One day I would have my dream home. My wildest fantasies didn't compare with life at school. Every day was an adventure, and before I knew it, I was graduating and going off to college. I chose an Eastern college. Mom and Dad were very proud, and soon I was living my own life on the East Coast, sending letters and cards when I could, but basically making my own way in the world. I came home for Christmas vacation during my sophomore year, and for the first time I realized that Mom and Dad's relationship seemed strained. I asked Mom about it, and she said that she hadn't been feeling well. She blamed her quiet mood on a slow recovery from the flu. I suspected that there was more to it, but I didn't ask. Mom did, or Dad, did his best to be his vibrant, noisy self. But I found him sitting quietly a few times, and I could tell that something was weighing on his mind. I tried to ask him about it, but he simply changed the subject. Whatever was bothering my parents was deeply private, and I was forced to put it out of my mind as I went back to school and work. Mom told me several months later that Dad had taken a job that required a lot of travel. I thought this would be our time, she said sadly, but he's gone nearly every week. To her credit, my mother got involved in volunteer work with her church and in the community. I was proud of her, although I knew that she was lonely without Dad. Whenever I saw them together, my parents seemed as close as ever, but there was something about the way they treated each other that bothered me. It was as if they were too polite and a little too careful about what they said to each other. I've noticed it too, Bert, my youngest brother, said. Maybe one of them is sick and they don't have the guts to tell us. They're healthy, Harold interjected. Healthy as horses. They're just getting on in years. You know how couples are. Just leave it alone. Bert and I weren't convinced, but we agreed to drop the subject that day. I wish with all my heart we hadn't. Mom and Dad came to my graduation. Dad was beaming when I told him that I'd accepted a job that would put me just a few miles away from Mom. I could hardly wait to get to California and find my own apartment. Dad said he'd make it a point to be in town when I moved. My father did more than help me move my few boxes and suitcases. He drove me around so that I could see the changes that had been made in the community since I'd left home. I never thought I'd be able to live here, I told him. This is like a dream come true. How about adding to that dream? He asked with a twinkle in his eyes. How about living in one of those houses you always said you'd live in? I couldn't afford it, I gasped. You could if it was yours, he said with a grin. Then he handed me the keys and a copy of the deed to the house. I was overwhelmed and burst into tears. You'll cry harder when you see how much work it needs. He laughed. I'm counting on you to fix it up. I got it for a steal, and I'd like to see you get a big return on this investment. Every free moment I worked on that house, I sanded the floors and refinished them. I spent hours searching for just the right wallpaper for the parlor. I went to flea markets and garage sales in search of cast-off furniture that I could refinish. I admit I didn't have much of a social life because most of my time was taken up with work and my new home. But one weekend I was at the hardware store, and I literally rammed my cart into a tall, handsome man. "You owe me dinner for that," he said, chuckling. "That is, if you're free." "I'm painting today," I said. "I suppose that means you won't be eating?" "Well, sure, I was going to grab a burger." "Good, you can grab one for me, too." He smiled. "My name is Monroe, and if you tell me where to meet you, I'll be there so you can buy my dinner." I rattled off the name of a burger place and the time. Then I raced from the store with a flushed face because there was something about the way Monroe had looked at me that made me feel things I hadn't felt in a very long time. It was nearly 6 o'clock when I finished the painting. The small bedroom had gone from a small-looking dark blue box to a soft vanilla room that needed a day bed decorated with lacy pillows. I gasped when I saw the time. I told Monroe to meet me at 6. I barely had time to brush my hair. I didn't even bother changing my clothes, even though they were spattered with paint. "Very nice," he said when he saw me. "You dressed up for me. I always love it when a woman is wearing paint." "Are you always so sarcastic?" I asked. "Only when I'm nervous," he admitted. "And lady, you make me nervous." "I make you nervous?" I blushed. He had no idea that effect he was having on me. "Like a cat," he laughed. "You're beautiful, and you paint. What more could a guy ask?" He had to be married. There was no way a man with such a beautiful smile and gorgeous tan could be single. But as it turned out, Monroe was single, having been divorced for nearly 2 years. We married so young that we didn't have a clue about what marriage was about, he told me. So we grew apart. She is married to my former best friend now. They have a baby girl. If it sounds like a fairy tale, it was better than that. Monroe was a carpenter, and he specialized in fixing up old homes. 3 weeks after our first meeting, I felt I knew him well enough to show him my house. He marveled at the work I'd done myself. He made some suggestions and even offered to help. Slowly, he moved into my life and into my house. When we had the backyard fixed up just the way he'd imagined, we called a minister and got married there. Mom and Dad were thrilled, as were my brothers. I didn't think life could get any better, but I was wrong. In the spring, I discovered that I was pregnant. Although we hadn't intended to start a family so soon, we rejoiced. In October, we welcomed little Kate into our hearts and our lives. She was a good baby who so spoiled us that we began making plans to have another child right after Kate's first birthday. It was in my 7th month of pregnancy that Daddy died of a massive heart attack. He'd gone to Pittsburgh to some sort of convention. Even though he'd retired, he still acted as a consultant and traveled almost as much as he had when he was working full-time. He was in perfect health. I sobbed into Monroe's arms. He just had a checkup, and the doctor said that he was fine. Mom was devastated and could barely function. My brothers and I did what we could, but we were all so unprepared for such a loss that we were beside ourselves with shock and grief. Hundreds of people came to Dad's funeral. I know he had a lot of friends, but I never realized how well respected he was in the community. Several schools sent flowers. I thanked the principals and only then learned that Dad donated quite a bit of money to their libraries. He had always had a passion for books, and because of him, young men and women were able to borrow books that a school library never would have been able to afford. Despite the shock and the pain, my brothers and I found things to smile about. Dad had expressed his love to us in so many ways. The afternoon after his funeral, we sat together and shared our favorite stories. In our opinion, he'd been the perfect husband and father. We weren't in a huge hurry to read Dad's will because we all knew that he left everything to Mom. He'd even made sure that she could access their savings and checking accounts if anything happened to him, and he hadn't changed his will in years. So we didn't even go to see the lawyer until a month had passed. The attorney began reading the will, and none of us were surprised that he'd left the house he and Mom had shared, his bonds, the money he'd invested, and what seemed like everything else to Mom. We were surprised to learn that he had several investment properties throughout California, and he'd left each one of my brothers a share in them. I waited for the attorney to tell me that the house I'd been living in for the past several years was mine. The scream I heard when the attorney rattled off the owner of the house was my own. Not only had Dad willed the house to some woman I'd never heard of, but he'd given her an additional property in Pennsylvania as well. "There must be some mistake," I said. "Didn't he leave me anything?" "Sure," the lawyer said. He read the properties Dad left him. Not one of the addresses sounded familiar. I began to sob, but before I could deal with the injustice of the will, I realized that the wretched, uncomfortable physical feeling that I was experiencing was labor. Monroe rushed me to the hospital, and our little Jacob Monroe was born nearly 6 weeks early. He's the tiniest baby I've ever seen, Monroe said of our 5-pound baby boy, but he's a fighter. All of the nurses in the intensive care nursery say so. I thought my dad loved me, I sniffled. So much had happened that I couldn't even think of my new baby at that moment. We were going to lose our house, and I didn't know why. "We'll be okay," my husband reassured me. "We've got enough money saved. We can buy a house. That's our home," I wept bitterly. "We are going to lose our house." Monroe shrugged. "So we'll move on it." So we'll move, that is. He didn't understand that the house itself wasn't the issue. It was Dad's betrayal that hurt me in a way nothing ever had. My son needed me, but emotionally I had little to give. I did my best to care for him, but my anxiety was so great that I had trouble sitting still long enough to feed him. I'd breastfed Kate, but I just couldn't seem to do so with Jacob. Mom clucked disapprovingly. I told her as nicely as I could to mind her own business. I'm sure this whole house issue is nothing but some kind of clerical error, she stated. Your father wouldn't take your home away from you. You need to relax and spend time enjoying your babies. Children grow up so soon. The time just flies by, and the next thing you know, they've got little ones of their own. I'm sure you're right, Mom, I said, although I didn't mean a word of it. Although I didn't mean a word of it. It was easy for her to give out advice. Daddy had left her with a bundle. I was facing a court battle or the loss of my house. 6 weeks after Jacob's birth, I felt well enough to go to the courthouse to do some research. My friend Stacy, a paralegal, agreed to meet me there. She helped me trace the history of the home. I carefully wrote down all of the information about the house, how it had been built in the 20s and had only had four owners. One of them was a certain Wallace Harper, who sold the house to Dad for its appraised value only. I wondered about that, but the deed was in Dad's name, so it had to have been a fair deal. "Then that woman can't have it," I said, chuckling. "He never put her name on the deed." "I don't know," Stacy said. "It seems pretty clear to me that the house may be your mother's, because it was property that belonged to him. But if he willed it to this other woman, well, I just don't know what the court will say about the matter." Monroe and I thought it strange that the woman didn't contact us. We did a name search for her on the internet and turned up little more than an address. The fact that she lived in Pittsburgh and was to be given my house in California struck me as odd. "Maybe you should just call her and stop obsessing about it," Monroe suggested. "She might be some little old lady that did a kindness for your dad. Maybe she's a librarian and he wanted to give her the house so she could sell it for library books." "That doesn't make sense," I wailed. He gave the house to me. He even gave me a copy of the deed." Gradually, I began to relax. As long as no one got in touch with me about the house, I could pretend that it was mine. I started to really enjoy being with my children. Monroe built Kate a playhouse in the backyard and even made a baby swing for Jacob so he could sit and watch his big sister play in the yard. I could sit right beside him and read or crochet. We spent an idyllic summer splashing in the wading pool, attending story time at the library, and playing in the backyard. By the time the leaves were changing color, I'd nearly forgotten about the reading of Daddy's will. One crisp October morning, before I'd even had my morning cup of tea, someone knocked on my door. It was barely light out. I tightened my robe around me as I made my way to the front of the house. When I opened the door, I was face to face with the sheriff. He handed me a thick sheaf of papers. I was being served in a lawsuit. The woman Dad had left the house to was suing me to get me out of the house. Now that I knew the battle lines had been drawn, I was strangely calm. I telephoned Stacy, who gave me the name of the best attorney she knew. He immediately took my call and we met that afternoon. "I don't think she has a case," he said, "but I have to find out who she was to your father. This may be painful for all involved. You may want to forewarn your family." "Oh, I'm sure she's just some woman that took advantage of him," I replied quickly. "Daddy wasn't involved with her. If he had been, we would have known." I returned home to agonize over what was about to happen. My attorney went to work on my case. I thought I could help by quizzing Mom about the woman. But whenever I broached the subject, Mom just turned away, or said that she didn't know why my father would have willed property to anyone outside our family. "Maybe she's an old teacher of his," I suggested to my brothers, "or someone he worked with." I began to make daily calls to my attorney, but he was too busy to call back. More than once, his secretary told me that all I needed to do was to show up in court. I promised that I would, but I was hoping for a little more information about my opponent before I jumped into the fray. She doesn't have a snowball's chance in Miami of winning, Monroe said as we dressed for court. She doesn't even live in California. The judge would be a fool to award her anything. She probably won't even be there, I said. No doubt she has an attorney who is going to do her dirty work for her. In my mind, I vacillated between two fantasies. In one, I was going to be facing an elderly woman who didn't have long to live and who had somehow gained Daddy's sympathies. In the other, Daddy's mistress, a woman many years his junior and more glamorous than anyone in Hollywood, was going to be in court. Even Mom said that perhaps Dad had met the woman on the road, and that was why she was in his will. He had a fear of aging, she recalled out loud. Perhaps she made him feel young. Mom refused to come to court, saying she didn't want to come face to face with someone from Dad's past, that she didn't know Monroe, and I knew that it was her way of denying that Dad had lived any type of life apart from her. I couldn't blame her for wanting to avoid the truth. My dad was a short, paunchy guy who wore his hair in a stiff comb-over. He wasn't exactly a debonair movie star, the kind that women fall all over themselves to meet. Monroe and I arrived early and sat waiting outside the courtroom on a hard wooden bench. I scanned everyone that passed, hoping for a glimpse of the mystery woman in Dad's life. I didn't see anyone that matched my fantasy description. I breathed a sigh of relief and told myself that she hadn't shown up. The bailiff ushered us into the courtroom, and all too soon, the judge was calling for our case. My attorney stood up and presented his arguments. The attorney for Margaret Carol Stedman countered with what he said was irrefutable proof that Dad wanted Maggie, as she was called, to have my home. Where was this woman who had such interest in the property that she dragged me into court? The lawyers argued about this and that. Then Maggie's attorney had someone take the stand to show pictures of the property and define the exact boundary lines. Monroe gave me a look that said he was baffled by the whole thing. Wasn't this case supposed to be about two women who had been told by one man that they owned a house? Maggie showed up in court after our lunch break. She was wearing a navy blue suit, matching blue shoes, and carried a small leather-bound notebook in which she wrote the occasional note. Her eyes were bright blue, her hair gray like Mom's, and she smiled at me when she saw me. "You must be Jacqueline," she stated as she extended her hand. "Your father told me so much about you." I shook her hand, but couldn't resist asking, "If Dad told you so much about me, why are you taking my house?" "Oh, that," she said with a shrug. "It's mine. He always said it would be." Her smile was like that of a tiger, all teeth and seemingly ready to pounce. "No," I said through tightly clenched teeth. "It's mine. He gave it to me." Maggie smiled. He was a forgetful man sometimes, wasn't he? Her seeming familiarity with him just galled me. I wanted to scratch her eyes out, but fortunately my big, strong husband put his arm around me and said loudly, "We'd better get back inside." He guided me to my seat and wouldn't let me say another word to Maggie. "She's just trying to get you angry," he said. "If you create a scene and the judge finds out, maybe she'll have more of a chance." So that was her strategy. Well, I had a strategy of my own. I leaned back and smiled. We'd be back in court the following morning, and I'd make sure the judge knew just what he'd be taking away from my family if he awarded Maggie the house. The story of Daddy and Maggie broke my heart. I was glad that Mom had chosen not to come to court. The only thing my attorney needed her testimony for would be at the end of the trial, when she'd have to testify that she didn't know a thing about Dad changing his will. Maggie testified that she'd met Dad at a convention they attended years before. She was a newly divorced mother of a 2-year-old. She knew she was married. He was married, and said that she hadn't asked him for any type of commitment. She was lonely, and so, apparently, was he. They had a brief encounter, and she thought that was the end of it. Then I discovered that I was pregnant, she stated. That changed everything. She packed up her things and moved to California. There she began a new life, learning as much as she could about Dad, without even letting him know how close she lived. My uncle put me up in one of his old houses, she said softly. I had my baby, and I did the best I could to take care of my little family. Dad had another child? That couldn't be possible. I scribbled a note to my attorney telling him that he had to demand a paternity test so we could disprove this claim of hers. I became ill, and my uncle went to see Scott, she continued. Scott immediately came to see me. When he saw our daughter, he knew right away whose child she was. He demanded that I tell him the whole story. I did, and that day he gave me a check for $2,000, enough to set us right with the creditors and buy some groceries and things the children needed. That sounded like my dad. Even if the child was not his, he would have helped the poor woman out. I leaned closer to hear what she said next. I began to get better. I returned to work, and Scott and I began seeing each other regularly. It was pretty easy to put what Maggie was saying together with what I knew to be true. Mom and Dad had been a little too polite with each other when I came home from college. Mom had denied that anything was wrong. My brothers insisted that I was imagining things, but the time frame Maggie referred to indicated that my instincts had been correct. Something had been going on. Dad had been living a lie during that time. While I'd adored him from afar, he'd been living with a whole other family just a few miles from where he and Mom lived. She thought he was traveling when he was really with his mistress. I was sick to my stomach and sick at heart. How could someone I loved so much betray us all like this? I didn't call Mom that evening to tell her what had happened in court. I fell across the bed weeping, because everything in my world had just tilted. I could give up the house, but I didn't want to give up the image I had of my father. I wanted to believe that he'd been faithful and had always put us first. Now I knew differently, and it was a bitter pill to swallow. I made some soup and sandwiches for dinner when Rose said from the doorway, "You need to spend some time with our children." I knew that he was right, but I was so full of self-pity. It was a struggle just to get up and go into the kitchen. Kate showed me the picture she had drawn. Jacob laughed and banged on the tray of his high chair. I felt myself beginning to relax. I had everything I needed in that room. I didn't need to hang on to my old ideas or the house. "Maybe we should start looking around for another house to fix up," I said after I'd eaten, "or think about moving up north a bit." "Oregon is nice," Monroe agreed. There are some lovely old homes in Portland. The idea appealed to me so much that after the children were asleep, I went on the internet and looked at available real estate in Oregon. We'd make a new life for ourselves, one untainted by my father's indiscretion. If Maggie won the house, I'd give it up as gracefully as I could. You have probably already deduced that the house I was living in was the one Maggie's uncle owned, the one she and her children moved to when they came to California. I was curious about how Daddy purchased the house and why he'd willed it to her. According to Maggie, he bought the home from her uncle so that she and the children could continue to live in it. He paid all of our expenses, she said. We didn't need anything. The problem was that Dad was retiring and his two worlds were about to collide. Mom expected him to be at home more often and to participate in the plans the two of them had made, and Maggie wanted him to continue to be with her and the children. In the end, Dad arranged for Maggie to take a job in Pittsburgh. He traveled there so frequently that he assured her he'd spend more time with her when he wasn't worried about Mom finding out. She agreed, and she packed up the girls and moved. She loved her job and her new home. Her oldest child was doing well in school. Everything was going great. Dad told her that he'd let me move into the house temporarily to fix it up. I thought my heart would burst from pain when she read the letter he'd written describing my wedding to Monroe. He even said that one day he might be walking their daughter down the aisle, and he wanted her to know that he had plenty of experience. I began to hate my father. In my dreams, I was setting him on fire, driving my car over him, or turning my back on him when he called to me for help. I resisted the urge to tear every photograph of him out of my photograph albums. How could he have been so duplicitous? The next morning, I was called to the stand. I explained how Daddy had given me the house and how Monroe and I fixed it up. My attorney even had me list the improvements we made and how much they cost. I knew where he was going with it. He intended to show the judge that when the house was in ruins, Maggie didn't want it. But now that it had been improved, she was determined to get it. My attorney asked me to tell the judge how I felt about losing my house. I cried as I told him that it was the only home my daughter had ever known, and I had even gone into early labor with my son because the shock and hurt were so great. When Maggie's attorney questioned me, he was kind and only asked me a few questions about the deed. He wanted to know why my name wasn't on it. I shrugged and said, "I don't know. My father probably felt that he'd live forever." I stepped down when the judge told me it was okay and went back to my seat. Out of the corner of my eye, I thought I saw my mother, but I knew she wouldn't be in court that day. She wasn't scheduled to come in until the following morning. When we took a recess, I learned that it was Mom, and she was furious. She sought Maggie out, and right there in the corridor, she hit the woman with her purse. "You bitch," she screamed. "It wasn't enough that you took the best years of his life, but now you want my daughter's house. How could you?" Again, Maggie smiled that predatory smile as if she'd been waiting for Mother all along. She purred, "Poor Beatrice, you must be so lonely now." Mom flew at her, but Monroe was quick enough to pull her away and to keep me back so I didn't take on Maggie myself. "Enough," he snapped. "Not another word." He quickly pulled Mom and me out of the courthouse. "There has to be something more to this," he said. "It doesn't make It doesn't make sense that a woman that lives in Pittsburgh suddenly wants to return to California. A buddy of mine told me that the town she lives in is idyllic for raising children. More to the point, the cost of living is much less than here. The property your dad willed to her is a very nice parcel of land. The lady is set for life. She's here to make trouble, and you two are playing right into her hands. What are we supposed to do? I sputtered. Let her have our house? No, but the more I hear, the more I'm convinced that there's more to the story. If your dad was so in love with her, how come he didn't say so in any of his letters? My lawyer says there isn't anything more to it, I pouted. He says we just have to let the judge decide. Monroe held up his hand to signal that he had an idea. I'm going to Pittsburgh, he said. I'm going to check with every work crew in the area and see what I can find out about Miss Maggie Stedman. You aren't any sort of investigator. You aren't any sort of investigator, Mom reminded him. Are you sure you want to do this? If we can get your lawyer to stall a bit, yeah, he grinned. There's something really wrong with this whole picture. I have to find out what it is. If it's nothing, we'll pack and go quietly, okay? Okay, I said, although I knew if the judge awarded the house to Maggie, I'd at least have a hank of her hair in my hand before I let her anywhere near my home. Monroe left on the midnight flight. I went home and spent a restless 5 hours trying to get some sleep. In the morning, I arrived at the courthouse. My lawyer requested that Maggie be put back on the stand. He spent the entire day interviewing her about every letter she'd brought to show that Dad wanted her to have the house. He asked her if she had an engagement ring, and she said that she did not, although she claimed that Dad had often promised to leave Mom to marry Maggie. He asked her if she had dated at all since having my little stepsister. She said that she had not. I hoped Monroe was finding out if this was true, because if she had more than one boyfriend, the judge might see her as a gold digger and leave my property alone. Monroe claimed that Dad referred to her as his old lady on many occasions. She even claimed that her children called him Papa. During a break, Mom and I wondered aloud why she hadn't brought the children with her to testify, and neither of us could believe that Dad referred to a woman as his old lady. Monroe called briefly that night, but he didn't tell me what he'd discovered. Mom and I went to court that morning, and Mom testified about her marriage to Dad. He was a workaholic, she said. I begged him to stop working himself so hard, but he wouldn't slow down. So he continued to do it. His one regret was that he hadn't spent enough time with his children. I wiped the tears away as Mom talked about their last trip together. They talked about taking a cruise and building a cabin at their favorite lake. I just can't believe that he never felt a need to give me some sort of warning. He had a few secrets. Monroe called me when I got home. I'll see you tomorrow, he promised. I love you. Wait, I yelled before he could hang up. What did you find out? Plenty, but I have to run. Kate and I had pizza for dinner that night after Jacob had gone to bed. Hi, sweetie, I said as I cheerfully answered the phone. Oh, I don't think I'm that good a lawyer. It was my attorney. I could feel my face turning beet red. Actually, he said softly, I telephoned to apologize to you. I asked a friend to run a check on Maggie for me. Then, when he came back empty, I figured that her story checked out. Monroe has dug up enough information to bring her whole house of cards down around her. You've talked to Monroe? I asked. When is he coming back? What did he find out? All in good time, he said. I just want you to know that I'm waiving a good portion of my fee because your husband did all the work. I dressed carefully for court the next morning. I wasn't sure what to expect, but I pulled on my best suit and made sure to check everything twice before leaving the house. In court, my attorney was arguing over a technical matter when Monroe strolled into court. I watched Maggie's face as he and his entourage took their places behind my attorney. She went white and then she pressed her lips together as if she was afraid she'd say something she shouldn't. I didn't know what Monroe was up to, but he had a whole lot of people with him, and they all looked anxious to have their say. The story of who Maggie really was made the front page of the newspaper. It was true that she had a one-night stand with my father, but after that, the story became more interesting than anything I've ever heard. She has the habit of finding men that are lonely, getting them drunk, and then taking advantage of them, her brother testified. A businessman who had been paying Maggie child support for her fourth child that was supposedly his said the same thing. I was lonely, discouraged, and drunk. Maggie was a warm body. I never expected her to call me and tell me that I was a father, but I wanted to do the right thing. Suddenly, it all made sense. My father, in a moment of weakness, had been with Maggie one time, and she'd blackmailed him for years. The thing is, she was getting more than one check for each child, her brother told the judge. None of this explained a thing about the house. That information came from Maggie herself, who finally admitted under cross-examination by my lawyer that she'd conned my father, along with a couple of other men, into supporting the child. How did you happen to be mentioned in Scott's will? The lawyer asked. Maggie said softly, I told him that it was my mama's house. I told him my uncle had molested me most of my life, and that's why he let us live there. I explained to him that my uncle had taken the house away from me when mama died. He thought he was giving me what was rightfully mine. Maggie's brother, a construction worker, leapt to his feet and yelled, Our mama isn't, she ain't even dead. Your Honor, he bellowed. She helped me pack my things to come here. How did you ever learn so much about Maggie so quickly? I asked Monroe as we hugged each other in the hallway. I went to the Union Hall, he said. There's a sort of code between union members. I told them what I was trying to find out, and they all helped. We went back into the courtroom when the bailiff called us. The judge told Maggie that she was a selfish woman who deserved jail time if any of us wanted to press charges. He then declared that she had absolutely no right to my home or anything else belonging to Daddy, including the other property he'd left to her. You engaged him in years of emotional turmoil and upset, he said firmly, and because your relationship with him was based on a lie, he could not have known that you had no right to any of the properties. Maggie screamed at me in the hallway and threatened all sorts of lawsuits. It was time for me to have my say once and for all. I gave her the same sort of triumphant smile she'd given my mother and said, Poor Maggie, you must be so lonely now. Maggie's brother smiled and applauded. She'll be out there looking for some other guy to take advantage of, he said. Mama and I don't want to have anything to do with her because this is how she chooses to live. I thanked him with all my heart. He laughed and shook Monroe's hand one more time. You're a union, buddy, he said modestly. You know how we value that. Besides, I finally got to say some things to my sister that I have wanted to say for years. That night, I tucked my children into bed and thanked God that we wouldn't have to leave our home. I also said a prayer for Dad. Maggie's greed had given me a whole new appreciation for the man my father was. He was human and had a lot of faults, but in spite of everything, he'd always tried to do the right thing. Thank you, Dad, I breathed as I went to join my husband in our own bedroom. Thank you for letting me see the real you, not my idolized version. Okay, that's the end of that story. If you tuned in late, this is the Romance Program with volunteer Jeannie Yost for Sun Sounds. I have a little bit of time left, so I'm going to read a poem from True Romance magazine. This one was written by Beth Baylor, and it's called A Non-Cook Marries. Here's the poem. When I got engaged, I should have registered at the A&P. Well-wishers could have given me paper plates or a year's supply of napkins. They could even have gifted me coupons instead of assorted plastic forks, knives, and spoons, certainly instead of the fancy china place settings, brand, and design I guess we picked out ourselves. I thought I had received 8 place settings and was finally going to use them when I saw we only have 7 settings, and I don't remember throwing even a single dish at you. I do have silverware for 8, but where do I put it? And casserole plates. Remind me, what are casseroles? At least we have 2 crystal glasses left, so I can toast being alone with you. So grateful for microwavable dinners and a good non-cookbook. Okay, that is going to do it for this romance program. This has been volunteer Jeannie Yost for Sun Sounds. Thank you, as always, for listening to my stories and my poems. I enjoyed reading to you. Have a great week and take care of yourselves. This has been The Romance Show with volunteer Jeannie Yost for Sun Sounds. Bye-bye.